see a son striking his own mother and driving her out, and nobody daring to say a word to him. The male members of the family are equal among themselves. If you entertain them with vodka, then you also have to treat the very smallest of them to it as well. But the female members are all equal in their lack of rights, be it grandmother, mother, or baby girl still being nursed. They are ill-treated in the same way as domestic animals, like an object which can be thrown out, sold, or shoved with one's foot like a dog. However, the Gilyaks at least fondle their dogs, but their womenfolk, never. Marriage is considered a mere trifle, of less importance, for instance, than a drinking spree, and it is not surrounded by any kind of religious or superstitious ceremony. A Gilyak exchanges a spear, a boat, or a dog for a girl, takes her back to his own yurt, and lies with her on a bearskin, and that is all there is to it. Polygamy is allowed, but it has not become widespread, although to all appearances there are more women than men. Contempt toward women, as if for a lower creature or object, reaches such an extreme in the Gilyak that, in the field of the question of women's rights, he does not consider reprehensible even slavery in the literal and crude sense of the word. Evidently, with them, a woman represents the same sort of trading object as tobacco or nankeen. The Swedish writer Strindberg, a renowned misogynist, who desired that women should be merely slaves and should serve men's whims, is in essence of one and the same mind as the Gilyaks. If he ever chanced to come to northern Sakhalin, they would spend ages embracing each other. Tengo took a break at that point, but Fukaeri remained silent, offering no opinion on the reading. Tengo continued. They have no courts, and they do not know the meaning of justice. How hard it is for them to understand us may be seen merely from the fact that up till the present day they still do not fully understand the purpose of roads. Even where a road has already been laid, they will still journey through the taiga. One often sees them, their families and their dogs, picking their way in Indian file across a quagmire right by the roadway. Fukaeri had her eyes closed and was breathing very softly. Tengo studied her face for a while, but could not tell whether she was sleeping or not. He decided to turn the page and keep reading. If she was sleeping, he wanted to give her as sound a sleep as possible, and he also felt like reading more Chekhov aloud. Formerly, the Naibuchi post stood at the river mouth. It was founded in 1866. Mitsul found 18 buildings there, both dwellings and non-residential premises, plus a chapel and a shop for provisions. One correspondent who visited Naibuchi in 1871 wrote that there were 20 soldiers there under the command of a cadet officer. In one of the cabins he was entertained with fresh eggs and black bread by a tall and beautiful female soldier, who eulogized her life here and complained only that sugar was very expensive. Now there are not even traces left of those cabins, and gazing round at the wilderness, the tall, beautiful female soldier seems like some kind of myth. They are building a new house here for overseers' offices or possibly a weather center, and that is all. The roaring sea is cold and colorless in appearance, and the tall gray waves pound upon the sand as if wishing to say in despair, "O God, why did you create us?" This is the great, or, as it is otherwise known, the Pacific Ocean. On this shore of the Naibuchi River, the convicts can be heard rapping away with axes on the building work, while on the other, far distant, imagined shore, lies America. To the left, the capes of Sakhalin are visible in the mist, and to the right are more capes, while all around there is not a single living soul, not a bird, not a fly, and it is beyond comprehension who the waves are roaring for, who listens to them at nights here, what they want, and finally, who they would roar for when I was gone. There on the shore one is overcome not by connected logical thoughts, but by reflections and reveries. It is a sinister sensation, and yet at the very same time you feel the desire to stand forever looking at the monotonous movement of the waves and listening to their threatening roar. It appeared that Fukaeri was now sound asleep. He listened for her quiet breathing. He closed the book and set it on the little table by the bed. Then he stood up and turned the light off, taking one final look at Fukairi. She was sleeping peacefully on her back, her mouth a tight, straight line. Tengo closed the bedroom door and went back to the kitchen. It was impossible for him to continue with his writing, though. His mind was now fully occupied by Chekhov's desolate Sakhalin coastal scenes. He could hear the sound of the waves. When he closed his eyes, Tengo was standing alone on the shore of the Sea of Okhotsk, a prisoner of his own meditations, sharing in Chekhov's inconsolable melancholy. What Chekhov must have felt there at the end of the earth was an overwhelming sense of powerlessness. To be a Russian writer at the end of the 19th century must have meant bearing an inescapably bitter fate. The more they tried to flee from Russia, the more deeply Russia swallowed them. After rinsing his wine glass and brushing his teeth, Tengo turned off the kitchen light, stretched out on the sofa, pulled a blanket over himself, and tried to sleep. The roar of the ocean still echoed in his ears, but eventually he began to lose consciousness and was drawn into a deep sleep. He awoke at 8:30 in the morning. There was no sign of Fukairi in his bed. The pajamas he had lent her were balled up and tossed into the bathroom washing machine, the cuffs and legs still rolled up. He found a note on the kitchen table. "How are the Gilyaks doing now? I'm going home." Written in ballpoint pen on notepaper, the characters were small, square, and indefinably strange, like an aerial view of characters written on a beach in seashells. He folded the paper and put it in his desk drawer. If his girlfriend found something like this when she arrived at 11, she would make a terrible fuss. Tengo straightened the bed and returned the fruits of Chekhov's labor to the bookcase. Then he made himself coffee and toast. While eating breakfast, he noticed that some kind of heavy object had settled itself in his chest. Some time had to go by before he figured out what it was. Fukairi's tranquil, sleeping face. Could I be in love with her? No, impossible, Tengo told himself. It just so happens that something inside her has physically shaken my heart. So then, why am I so concerned about the pajamas she had on her body? Why did I, almost unconsciously, pick them up and smell them? There were too many questions. It was probably Chekhov who said that the novelist is not someone who answers questions, but someone who asks them. It was a memorable phrase, but Chekhov applied this attitude not only to his works, but to his life as well. His life presented many questions, but answered none. Although he knew quite well that he was suffering from an incurable lung disease, as a doctor he could not help but know, he tried hard to ignore the fact and refused to believe he was dying until he was actually on his deathbed. He died young, violently coughing up blood. Tengo left the kitchen table, shaking his head. My girlfriend is coming today. I have to do laundry and clean the place up now. Thinking is something I can save for later.
Chapter 21 Almame. No matter how far away I try to go. Almame went to the ward library and, following the same procedures as before, opened the compact edition of the newspaper on a desk. She was there to read once again about the gun battle between the radical faction and the police that had taken place in Yamanashi Prefecture in the autumn 3 years earlier. The headquarters of Sakigake, the religious group that the Dowager had mentioned, was located in the mountains of Yamanashi, and the gun battle had also occurred in the mountains of Yamanashi. This might have been a mere coincidence, but Aomame was not quite ready to accept that. There might well have been some link between the two. And the expression that the Dowager had used, "such a major incident," also seemed to suggest a connection. The gunfight had occurred 3 years earlier in 1981, or, according to Aomame's hypothesis, 3 years prior to 1Q84, on October 19th. Having read the news reports during her previous trip to the library, Almame had fairly detailed knowledge of the facts. This enabled her to skim through that material and concentrate instead on subsequent related articles and analyses that viewed the affair from different angles. In the first battle, three officers had been killed and two badly wounded by Chinese-made Kalashnikov automatic rifles. After that, the radical group fled into the mountains with their weapons, and the police staged a major manhunt. Fully armed self-defense force paratroopers were also sent in by helicopter. Three radicals who resisted the onslaught were shot to death. Two were gravely wounded. One of those died in the hospital 3 days later, but the fate of the other was not clearly stated in the article. And four others were arrested unharmed or slightly wounded. Wearing high-performance bulletproof vests, the police and self-defense troop suffered no further casualties except for one policeman's broken leg when he fell off of a cliff in pursuit of the radicals. Only one of the radicals was listed as whereabouts unknown. He had apparently managed to disappear in spite of the extensive search. Once the initial shock of the gun battle wore off, the newspapers started carrying detailed reports on the origins of the radical group, which was seen as the fallout from the university campus uprisings that occurred around 1970. More than half of the members were veterans of the takeover of Yasuda Hall at the University of Tokyo, or the sit-in at Nihon University. After their fortresses had fallen to the riot police, these students, and a few faculty members, had been expelled from their universities or become disillusioned with urban political action centered on the university campuses. They overcame their factional differences and started a communal farm in Yamanashi Prefecture. At first, they participated in the agricultural commune known as the Takashima Academy. But they were not satisfied with the life there. They reorganized, went independent, bought an abandoned village deep in the mountains at an exceptionally low price, and started farming there. They experienced many hardships at first, but they eventually succeeded in the mail-order sale of vegetables when the use of organically grown produce began a quiet boom in the cities. Their farm grew. They were, ultimately, serious, hard-working people whose leader had organized them well. The name of the commune was Sakigake. Aomame twisted her face into a major grimace and swallowed hard. She let out a deep groan and started tapping the surface of the desk with her ballpoint pen. She continued reading. She read through the news reports that explained how a deep split grew within the ranks of Sakigake, between a moderate group that rejected a violent revolution as acceptable for contemporary Japan, and a radical faction that eventually founded a nearby commune and took the name Akebono. She learned how they were granted religious status by the government in 1979. After the radical group moved to their own property, they underwent secret military training even as they continued to farm, which gave rise to several clashes with neighboring farmers. One such clash involved water rights over a stream that flowed through Akebono's land. The stream had always been used as a common source of water by farms in the area, but Akebono denied neighboring residents entry. The dispute went on for a number of years until several Akebono members severely beat a resident who had complained about the barbed wire fence surrounding their land. The Yamanashi Prefectural Police obtained a search warrant and headed for Akebono to question the suspects, only to become involved in a wholly unanticipated shootout. After Akebono was all but obliterated by the intense gun battle in the mountains, the religious organization, Sakigake, lost no time in issuing a formal statement. A handsome young spokesman in a business suit read the document to the media at a press conference. The point of the statement was quite clear. Whatever their relationship might have been in the past, Sakigake and Akebono now had no connection at all. after the two groups parted ways, there had been hardly any contact aside from certain operational matters. They had separated amicably after concluding that, as a community devoted to farming, respect for the law, and longing for a peaceful spiritual world, Sakigake could no longer work with the members of Akebono, who pursued a radical revolutionary ideology. After that, Sakigake had become a religious organization and had been legally certified as a religious juridical person. That such an incident involving bloodshed had occurred was truly unfortunate, and Sakigake wished to express its deep sympathy for the families of the officers who had lost their lives in the course of their duties. But Sakigake was in no way involved. Still, it was an undeniable fact that Sakigake had been the parent organization of Akebono. Consequently, if the authorities deemed it necessary to conduct some sort of investigation in connection with the present incident, Sakigake was fully prepared to comply so as to avoid pointless misunderstanding. A few days later, as if in response to Sakigake's formal statement, the Yamanashi Prefectural Police entered the organization's precincts with a search warrant. They spent an entire day covering all parts of Sakigake's extensive property and carefully examining their buildings' interiors and their files. They also questioned several members of the group's leadership. The police suspected that the two groups' contacts were as active as ever, and that Sakigake was surreptitiously involved in Akebono's activities. But they found no evidence to support this view. Scattered along the trails winding through the beautiful deciduous forest were wood-frame meditation huts where many members, dressed in ascetic robes, were engaged in religious austerities, nothing more. Nearby, other adherents were engaged in farming. There was an array of well-maintained farming implements and heavy farm machinery. The police found no trace of weapons or anything else suggesting violence. Everything was clean and orderly. There was a nice little dining hall, a lodging house, and a simple but adequately equipped medical facility. The two-floored library was well stocked with Buddhist scriptures and books, among which several experts were engaged in studies and translations. Overall, the place seemed less like a religious establishment than the campus of a small private college. The police left deflated, having found almost nothing of value. Some days later, the group welcomed television and newspaper reporters, who observed much the same scenes the police had found. They were not taken around on carefully controlled tours, as might be expected, but were allowed to wander freely throughout the property unaccompanied, to speak with anyone they wanted to interview, and to write up their discoveries as they wished. The one restriction agreed upon was that the media would use only television and photographic images approved by the group in order to protect the privacy of individual members. Several ascetic-robed members of the leadership answered reporters' questions in a large assembly hall, explaining the organization's origins, doctrines, and administration. Their manner of speaking was courteous but direct, eschewing any hint of the propaganda often associated with religious groups. They seemed more like top employees of an advertising agency, skilled presenters, rather than leaders of a religion. The only thing different was the clothes they wore. "We do not have any set, clear-cut doctrine," they explained. "We perform theoretical research on early Buddhism and put into actual practice the ascetic disciplines that were engaged in back then, aiming for more fluid religious awakening. We do not hold that doctrine gives rise to awakening, but rather that the individual awakenings come first. This is our fundamental principle. In that sense, our origin differs greatly from those of established religions. Now, as to our funding, like most other religious organizations, we depend in part on the spontaneous contributions of our believers. Our ultimate goal, however, is to establish a frugal, self-sufficient lifestyle through our farming, rather than depending on contributions. For us, less is more. We aim to achieve spiritual peace through the purification of the body and the discipline of the mind. One after another, people who have sensed the emptiness of competitive society's materialism have entered our gates in search of a different and deeper spiritual access. Many of them are highly educated professionals with social standing. We are not trying to be one of those fast food new religions that pretend to take on people's worldly suffering and save anyone and everyone. Salvation of the weak is, of course, an important task, but it may be best to think of us as a kind of graduate school, providing a suitable place and appropriate support to people who are strongly motivated to save themselves. Major differences of opinion arose at one point between us and the people of the Akebono commune concerning matters of administrative policy, and we were at odds with them for a time. But talks between us led to an amicable meeting of the minds. We then separated, each of us following a different path. Akebono pursued its ideals in its own pure-minded and ascetic way, but with those disastrous and genuinely tragic results. The single greatest cause was that they had become too doctrinaire and lost touch with actual living society. For us, too, the event has driven home the message that we must continue to be an organization that keeps a window open to the outside, even as we impose ever stricter discipline upon ourselves. We believe that violence solves nothing. We hope you understand that we do not force religion on anyone. We do not proselytize, nor do we attack other religions. All we do is offer an appropriate and effective communal environment to people in search of spiritual awakening. Most of the journalists present left with a favorable impression of the organization. All of the believers, both men and women, were slim, relatively young, though older people had been spotted on occasion, and beautifully clear-eyed. They were courteous in speech and behavior. None of them evidenced an inclination to speak extensively about their pasts, but most did indeed appear to be highly educated. The lunch served to the journalists had been simple fare, much the same sort of food eaten by believers, supposedly, but delicious in its own way, all ingredients having been freshly harvested on the organization's land. Subsequently, the media defined Akebono as a mutant offspring that Sakigake had had to shake off. A revolutionary ideology based on Marxism had become outmoded and useless in 1980s Japan. The youth with radical political aspirations in 1970 were now working for corporations, engaged in the forefront of fierce fighting on an economic battlefield. Or else they had put distance between themselves and the battle and clamor of real society, each in search of personal values in a place apart. In any case, the times had changed, and the season for politics was now a thing of the distant past. Sakigake was one hopeful option for a new world. Akebono had no future. Aomame set down her pen and took a deep breath. She pictured to herself the eyes of Tsubasa, so utterly lacking in expression or depth. Those eyes had been looking at Aomame, but at the same time, they had been looking at nothing. Something important was missing. "It's not as simple as all that," Aomame thought. "Sakigake can't be this clean. It has a hidden dark side. The dowager says this leader person is raping preteen girls and calling it a religious act. The media didn't seem to know anything about that. They were only there half a day. They were guided through the orderly facilities for religious practice. They were fed a lunch made with fresh ingredients. They were treated to beautiful explanations of spiritual awakening, and they went home satisfied. they never had a glimpse of what was really going on inside. Al-Mame went straight from the library to a cafe, where she ordered a cup of coffee and used the phone to call Ayumi at her office, on the number that Ayumi had told her she could call any time. A colleague picked up the phone. Ayumi was out making rounds, but should be back at the station in about 2 hours, he said. I'll call again later, Al-Mame said without giving her name. She went back to her apartment and dialed the number again 2 hours later. This time, Ayumi answered the phone herself.
Hi, Al-Mame. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Nothing wrong with me that a good man wouldn't fix. How about you?
Same here, Al-Mame said.
Too bad, Ayumi said. There must be something wrong with the world if women like us have to complain to each other about overly healthy sex drives. We'll have to do something about that.
True, but, is it okay for you to be saying stuff like that out loud? You're on duty, right? Isn't anybody else around?
Don't worry. You can talk to me about anything.
Well, I've got a favor to ask, if it's something you can do for me. I can't think of anyone else I can go to for this.
Sure, Ayumi said. I don't know if I can help or not, but give it a try.
Do you know of a religious group called Sakigake? It's headquartered in Yamanashi Prefecture, in the hills.
Sakigake.
Ayumi took some 10 seconds to search her memory.
I think I know it. It's a kind of religious commune, isn't it? The Akebono radicals that started the gun battle in Yamanashi used to belong to it. 3 prefectural policemen died in the shootout. It was a real shame. But Sakigake had nothing to do with it. Their compound was searched after the shootout and came up clean, so
I'd like to know if Sakigake was involved in any kind of incident after the shootout. Criminal, civil, anything. But I don't know how to go about looking into such things. I can't read all the compact editions of all the newspapers, but I figured the police probably had some way of finding out.
It's easy. We just have to do a quick search on our computer. Or, at least I wish I could say that. But I'm afraid computerization is not so advanced in Japan's police forces. I suspect it'll take a few more years to get to that stage. So for now, if I wanted to find out about something like that, I'd probably have to ask the Yamanashi Prefectural Police to send copies of the related materials in the mail. And for that, I'd first have to fill out a materials request form and get my boss's okay. Of course, I'd have to give a good reason for the request. And we're a government office, after all, so we're getting paid to make things as complicated as possible.
I see, Al-Mame said with a sigh. So that's out.
But why do you want to know something like that? Is some friend of yours mixed up in some kind of case connected to Sakigake?
Al-Mame hesitated a moment before deciding to tell Ayumi the truth. Close. It involves rape. I can't go into detail yet, but it's about the rape of young girls. I've been informed that they're systematically raping them in there, under cover of religion. Al-Mame could sense Ayumi wrinkling her brow at the other end.
The rape of young girls, huh? We can't let that happen, Ayumi said.
Of course we can't, Al-Mame said.
What do you mean by young?
Maybe 10? Or even younger? Girls who haven't had their first period, at least. Ayumi went silent for a while. Then, in a flat voice, she said,
I see what you mean. I'll think of something. Can you give me 2 or 3 days?
Sure. Just let me know. They spent the next few minutes in unrelated chatter, until Ayumi said,
Okay, I've got to get back to work.
After hanging up, Al-Mame sat in her reading chair by the window and stared at her right hand for a while. Long, slim fingers, closely trimmed nails. Nails well cared for, but unpolished. Looking at her nails,
Almame had a strong sense of what a fragile, fleeting thing her own existence was. Something as simple as the shape of her fingernails. It had been decided without her. Somebody else made the decision, and all I could do was go along with it, like it or not. Who could have decided that this was how my nails would be shaped? The dowager had recently said to her, "Your parents were, and still are, ardent believers in the Society of Witnesses," which meant that they were probably still devoting themselves to missionary work even now. Almame had a brother 4 years her senior, a docile young man. At the time Almame made up her mind to leave home, he was still living according to his parents' instructions, keeping the faith. What could he be doing now? Not that Almame had an actual desire to know what was happening with her family. To her, they were just a part of her life that had ended. The ties had snapped. Almame had struggled for a long time to forget everything that had happened to her before the age of 10. "My life actually started when I was 10. Everything before that was some kind of miserable dream. Let me throw those memories away somewhere." But try as she might, her heart was constantly being drawn back into that nightmarish world. It seemed to her that almost everything she possessed had its roots sunk in that dark soil and was deriving its nourishment from it. "No matter how far away I try to go, I always have to come back here," she thought. "I must send that leader into the other world," Almame told herself, "for my own sake as well." A phone call came from Ayumi 3 nights later. "I've got some facts for you," she said.
"About Sakigake?"
"Yes. I was mulling it over when all of a sudden I remembered that the uncle of one of my police academy classmates is on the Yamanashi Prefectural Police Force, a fairly high-ranking officer. So I tried asking my old classmate. I told him a relative of mine, a young girl, ran into some trouble when she was in the process of converting to that faith. So I was collecting information on Sakigake. And if you wouldn't mind, could he help me? I'm pretty good at making up stuff like that."
"Thanks, Ayumi. I appreciate it," Almame said.
So he called his uncle in Yamanashi and explained the situation, and the uncle introduced me to the officer in charge of investigating Sakigake. So I spoke to him directly.
"Oh, wonderful."
"Yep. Well, I had a long talk with him and got all kinds of information about Sakigake. But you probably know everything that was in the papers, so I'll just tell you the stuff that wasn't. The parts that aren't known to the public, okay?"
"That's fine."
"First of all, Sakigake has had a number of legal problems. Civil suits, mostly concerning land deals. They seem to have a lot of money, and they're buying up all the property around them. Sure, land is cheap in the country, but still. And a lot of times, they're pretty much forcing people to sell. They hide their involvement behind fake companies and buy up everything they can get their hands on. That way, they start trouble with landowners and local governments. I mean, they operate like an ordinary land shark. Up to now, though, it's all been civil actions, so the police haven't had to get involved. They've come pretty close to crossing the line into criminal territory. But so far, things haven't gone public. They might be involved with organized crime or politicians. The police back off when politicians are mixed up in it. Of course, it'll be a whole new ball game if something blows up and the prosecutor has to step in.
So Sakigake is not as clean as it looks where economic activity is concerned.
I don't know about their ordinary believers, but as far as I can tell from the records of their real estate transactions, the top people in charge of the funds are probably not that clean. Even trying to cast it in the best light, it's almost inconceivable that they would be using their money in search of pure spirituality. And besides, these guys hold land and buildings not just in Yamanashi, but in downtown Tokyo and Osaka. First-class properties. Shibuya, Minami Aoyama, Shoto. The organization seems to be planning to expand its religious activities on a national scale, assuming it's not going to switch from religion to the real estate business. I thought they wanted to live in natural surroundings and practice pure, stringent religious austerities. Why in the world would such an organization have to branch out to the middle of Tokyo?
And where do they get the kind of cash they're throwing around?
Ayumi added.
There's no way they could have amassed such a fortune selling daikon radishes and carrots.
Squeezing donations out of their believers.
That's part of it, I'm sure, but nowhere near enough. They must have some other major source of funds.
I also discovered another fact of some concern, something you might be interested in. There are a fair number of believers' children in the compound. They generally attend the local public elementary school, but most of them drop out before long. The school insists that the children follow the standard education program, but the organization won't cooperate. They tell the school that some of their children simply don't want to go there, that they themselves are providing an education for those children, so there is no need to worry about their studies.
Aomame recalled her own experience in elementary school. She could well understand why children from the religion wouldn't want to go to school, where they would be bullied as outsiders or ignored.
The kids probably feel out of place in a public school, she said. Besides, it's not that unusual for children not to go to school.
Yes, but according to the teachers who had those kids in their classes, most of them, boys and girls alike, appear to have some kind of emotional problems. They show up normal in first grade, just bright, outgoing children. But year by year, they grow less talkative. Their faces lose any hint of expression. Eventually, they become utterly apathetic and stop coming to school. Almost all of the Sakegake kids seem to go through the same stages and exhibit the same symptoms. The teachers are puzzled and worried about the kids who have stopped coming and stay shut up inside the compound. They want to know if the kids are okay, but they can't get in to see them. Nobody is allowed inside.
These were the same symptoms Tsubasa had, Aomame thought. Extreme apathy, lack of expression, barely talking.
Ayumi said to Aomame, "You imagine the kids in Sakegake are being abused?
Systematically. Maybe including rape.
But the police can't make a move based on unconfirmed accusations by an ordinary citizen."
"Of course not. The police department's just another bureaucratic government agency, after all. The top brass don't think of anything but their own careers. Some are not like that, but most of them have worked their way up playing it safe, and their goal is to find a cushy job in a related organization or private industry after they retire. So they don't want to touch anything the least bit risky or hot. They probably don't even eat pizza without letting it cool off. It would be an entirely different story if you could bring us a real victim who could prove something in court. But I'm guessing that would be hard for you to do."
"True. It might be hard," Aomame said. "But anyhow, thanks. This is really useful information. I'll have to find a way to thank you."
"Never mind that. Let's just have another night out in Roppongi sometime soon and forget about our problems."
"Sounds good to me," Aomame said.
"Now you're talking," Ayumi said. "By the way, are you at all interested in playing with handcuffs?"
"Probably not," Aomame said.
"Playing with handcuffs?" "No? Too bad," Ayumi said, sounding genuinely disappointed.
Chapter 22. Tengo. That time could take on deformed shapes as it moved ahead. Tengo thought about his brain. Lots of things made him do this. The size of the human brain had increased 4 times over the past 2.5 million years. In terms of weight, the brain occupied only 2% of the human body, but it consumed some 40% of the body's total energy, according to a book he had recently read. Owing to the dramatic expansion of the brain, human beings had been able to acquire the concepts of time, space, and possibility. The concepts of time, space, and possibility. Tengo knew that time could become deformed as it moved forward. Time itself was uniform in composition, but once consumed, it took on a deformed shape. One period of time might be terribly heavy and long, while another could be light and short. Occasionally, the order of things could be reversed, and in the worst cases, order itself could vanish entirely. Sometimes, things that should not be there at all might be added onto time. By adjusting time this way, to suit their own purposes, people probably adjusted the meaning of their existences. In other words, by adding such operations to time, they were able, but just barely, to preserve their own sanity. Surely, if a person had to accept the time through which he had just passed uniformly in the given order, his nerves could not bear the strain. Such a life, Tengo felt, would be sheer torture. Through the expansion of the brain, people had acquired the concept of temporality, but they simultaneously learned ways in which to change and adjust time. In parallel with their ceaseless consumption of time, people would ceaselessly reproduce time that they had mentally adjusted. This was no ordinary feat. No wonder the brain was said to consume 40% of the body's total energy. Tengo often wondered whether he had actually witnessed the memory he retained from the age of 1 1/2, or at most 2. The scene in which his mother, in underclothes, let a man who was not his father suck on her breasts. Her arms were wrapped around the man. Could a 1 or 2-year-old infant distinguish such details and remember them so vividly? Wasn't this a false memory that he had later conveniently fashioned to protect himself? That was entirely conceivable. At some point, Tengo's brain might have subconsciously created the memory of another man, his possibly real father, in order to prove that he was not the biological child of the man who was supposed to be his father. This was how he tried to eliminate the man who was supposed to be his father from the tight circle of blood. By establishing inside himself the hypothetical existence of a mother who must be alive somewhere, and a real father, he was trying to create a portal leading out of his limited, suffocating life. The problem with this view was that the memory came with such a vivid sense of reality. It had such an authentic feel and weight and smell and depth. It was stubbornly fastened to the walls of his mind like an oyster clinging to a sunken ship. He could never manage to shake it off, to wash it away. He found it impossible to believe that such a memory was a mere counterfeit that his mind had created in response to some need. It was too real, too solid to be imaginary. What if it was real, then? Tengo thought. His infant self would certainly have been frightened to witness such a scene. Someone else, some other human being, was sucking on breasts that should have been for him. Someone bigger and stronger. And it appeared that Tengo's mother had, at least temporarily, forgotten about him, creating a situation that threatened his very survival, small and weak as he was. The primal terror of that moment may have been indelibly imprinted on the photopaper of his mind. The memory of that terror came rushing back to him when he least expected it, attacking him with all the ferocity of a flash flood and putting him into a near panic. This terror spoke to him, forcing him to remember. Wherever you go, whatever you do, you can never escape the pressure of this water. This memory defines who you are, shapes your life, and is trying to send you to a place that has been decided for you. You can writhe all you want, but you will never be able to escape from this power. It suddenly occurred to Tengo. When I lifted the pajamas that Fukaeri wore from the washing machine and smelled them, I might have been hoping to find my mother's smell. But why do I have to look for my departed mother's image in, of all things, the smell of a 17-year-old girl? There should be a more likely place to look. In the body of my older girlfriend, for one thing. Tengo's girlfriend was 10 years his senior, but for some reason he never sought his mother's image in her. Neither did he have any particular interest in her smell. She took the lead in most of their sexual activity. Tengo simply did as she directed, hardly thinking, making neither choices nor judgments. She demanded only two things of him, good erections and well-timed ejaculations. "Don't come yet," she would command. "Hold on a little longer." And he would pour all his energy into holding on. "Okay, now, come now," she would whisper by his ear, and he would let go at precisely that point with as intense an ejaculation as he could manage. Then she would praise him, caressing his cheek. "Oh, Tengo, you're wonderful." Tengo had an innate knack for precision in all realms, including correct punctuation and discovering the simplest possible formula necessary to solve a math problem. It didn't work this way when he had sex with younger women. He would have to think from beginning to end, making choices and judgments. This made Tengo uncomfortable. All the responsibilities fell on his shoulders. He felt like the captain of a small boat on a stormy sea, having to take the rudder, inspect the setting of the sails, keep in mind the barometric pressure and the wind direction, and modulate his own behavior so as to boost the crew's trust in him. The slightest mistake or accident could lead to tragedy. This felt less like sex than the discharging of a duty. As a result, he would tense up and miss the timing of an ejaculation, or fail to become erect when necessary. This would only increase his doubts about himself. Such mistakes never happened with his older girlfriend. She fully appreciated him. She always praised and encouraged him. After the one time he ejaculated prematurely, she was careful never to wear a white slip again. And not just slips, she stopped wearing any white lingerie at all. That day she was wearing black lingerie, a matching top and bottom, as she performed fellatio on him, fully enjoying the hardness of his penis and the softness of his testicles. Tengo could see her breasts moving up and down, enfolded in the black lace of her bra as she moved her mouth. To keep himself from coming too soon, he closed his eyes and thought about the Gilyaks. They have no courts, and they do not know the meaning of justice. How hard it is for them to understand us may be seen merely from the fact that, up till the present day, they still do not fully understand the purpose of roads. Even where a road has already been laid, they will still journey through the taiga. One often sees them, their families and their dogs, picking their way in Indian file across a quagmire right by the roadway. Tengo imagined the scene, the shabbily dressed Gilyaks walking through the thick forest in line beside the road with their dogs and women, hardly speaking. In their concepts of time, space, and possibility, roads did not exist. Rather than walk on a road, they probably gained a clearer grasp of their own raison d'etre by making their way quietly through the forest, in spite of the inconvenience. "The poor Gilyaks," Fukaeri had said. Tengo thought of Fukaeri's face as she slept. She had fallen asleep wearing Tengo's two large pajamas, the sleeves and cuffs rolled up. He had lifted them from the washing machine, held them to his nose, and smelled them. "I can't let myself think about that," Tengo told himself, but it was already too late. The semen surged out of him in multiple violent convulsions and into his girlfriend's mouth. She took it in until he finished, then stepped out of bed and went to the bathroom. He heard her open the spigot, run the water, and rinse her mouth. Then, as if it had been nothing at all, she came back to the bed. "Sorry," Tengo said. "I guess you couldn't stop yourself," she said, caressing his nose with her fingertip. "That's okay. It's no big deal." "Did it feel that good?" "Fantastic," he said. "I think I can do it again in a few minutes." "I can hardly wait," she said, pressing her cheek against Tengo's bare chest. She closed her eyes, keeping very still. Tengo could feel the soft breath from her nose against his nipple. "Can you guess what your chest reminds me of when I see it?" she asked Tengo. "No idea." "A castle gate in a Kurosawa samurai movie." "A castle gate," Tengo said, caressing her back. "You know, like in Throne of Blood or Hidden Fortress. There's always a big, sturdy castle gate in those old black-and-white movies of his, all covered with these huge iron rivets. That's what I think of. Thick, solid. I don't have any rivets, though. I hadn't noticed, she said. Fukairi's Air Chrysalis placed on the bestseller lists the second week after it went on sale, rising to number one on the fiction list in the third week. Tengo traced the process of the book's ascent through the newspapers they kept in the cram school's teacher's lounge. Two ads for the book also appeared in the papers, featuring a photo of the book's cover and a smaller shot of Fukairi wearing the familiar, tight-fitting summer sweater that showed off her breasts so beautifully, taken, no doubt, at the time of the press conference. Long, straight hair falling to her shoulders, dark, enigmatic eyes looking straight at the camera. Those eyes seemed to peer through the lens and focus directly on something the viewer kept hidden deep in his heart, of which he was normally unaware. They did so neutrally, but gently. The 17-year-old girl's unwavering gaze was disconcerting. It was just a small black-and-white photograph, but the mere sight of it almost certainly prompted many people to buy the book. Komatsu had sent two copies of the book to Tengo a few days after it went on sale, but Tengo opened only the package, not the vinyl around the books themselves. True, the text inside the book was something he himself had written, and this was the first time his writing had taken the shape of a book. But he had no desire to open it and read it, or even glance at its pages. The sight of it gave him no joy. The sentences and paragraphs may have been his, but the story they comprised belonged entirely to Fukairi. Her mind had given birth to it. His minor role as a secret technician had ended long before, and the work's fate from this point onward had nothing to do with him. Nor should it. He shoved the two volumes into the back of his bookcase, out of sight, still wrapped in vinyl. For a while, after the one night Fukairi slept in his apartment, Tengo's life flowed along uneventfully. It rained a lot, but Tengo paid almost no attention to the weather, which ranked far down on his list of priorities. From Fukairi herself, he heard nothing. The lack of contact probably meant that she had no particular problems for him to solve. In addition to writing his novel every day, Tengo wrote a number of short pieces for magazines, anonymous jobs that anyone could do. They were a welcome change of pace, though, and the pay was good for the minimal effort involved. Three times a week, as usual, Tengo taught math at the cram school. He burrowed more deeply than ever into the world of mathematics in order to forget his concerns, issues involving Air Chrysalis and Fukairi, mainly. Once he entered the mathematical world, his brain switched circuits with a little click. His mouth emitted different kinds of words, his body began to use different kinds of muscles, and both the tone of his voice and the look on his face changed. Tengo liked the way this change of gears felt. It was like moving from one room into another, or changing from one pair of shoes into another. In contrast to the time he spent performing daily tasks or writing fiction, Tengo was able to attain a new level of relaxation, and even to become more eloquent, when he entered the world of mathematics. At the same time, however, he also felt he had become a somewhat more practical person. He could not decide who might be the real Tengo, but the switch was both natural and almost unconscious. He also knew that it was something he more or less needed. As a teacher, Tengo pounded into his students' heads how voraciously mathematics demanded logic. Here things that could not be proven had no meaning. But once you had succeeded in proving something, the world's riddles settled into the palm of your hand like a tender oyster. Tengo's lectures took on an uncommon warmth, and the students found themselves swept up in his eloquence. He taught them how to practically and effectively solve mathematical problems, while simultaneously presenting a spectacular display of the romance concealed in the questions it posed. Tengo saw admiration in the eyes of several of his female students, and he realized that he was seducing these 17- or 18-year-olds through mathematics. His eloquence was a kind of intellectual foreplay. Mathematical functions stroked their backs. Theorems sent warm breath into their ears. Since meeting Fukairi, however, Tengo no longer felt sexual interest in such girls, nor did he have any urge to smell their pajamas. Fukairi is surely a special being, Tengo realized. She can't be compared with other girls. She is undoubtedly someone of special significance to me. She is, how should I put it, an all-encompassing image projected straight at me, but an image I find it impossible to decipher. Still, I'd better end any involvement with Fukaeri. Tengo's rational mind reached this lucid conclusion. I should also put as much distance as possible between myself and the piles of air chrysalis displayed in the front of all the bookstores, and the inscrutable Professor Ebisuno, and that ominously mysterious religious organization. I'd also better keep away from Komatsu, at least for the time being. Otherwise, I'm likely to be carried into even more chaotic territory, pushed into a dangerous corner without a shred of logic, driven into a situation from which I can never extricate myself. But Tengo was also well aware that he could not easily withdraw from the twisted conspiracy in which he was now fully involved. He was no Hitchcockian protagonist, embroiled in a conspiracy before he knew what was happening. He had embroiled himself, knowing full well that it contained an element of risk. The machine was already in motion, gaining too much forward momentum for him to stop it. Tengo himself was one of its gears, and an important one at that. He could hear the machine's low groaning and feel its implacable motion. Komatsu called Tengo a few days after Air Chrysalis topped the bestseller list for the second week in a row. The phone rang after 11 o'clock at night. Tengo was already in bed in his pajamas. He had been reading a book for a while, lying on his stomach, and was just about to turn off the bedside light. Judging from the ring, he knew it was Komatsu. Exactly how, he could not explain, but he could always tell when the call was from Komatsu. The phone rang in a special way. Just as writing had a particular style, Komatsu's calls had a particular ring. Tengo got out of bed, went to the kitchen, and picked up the receiver. He did not really want to answer the call, and would have preferred to go quietly to sleep, to dream of Iriomota cats, or the Panama Canal, or the ozone layer, or Basho. Anything, as long as it was as far from here as possible. If he didn't answer the phone now, though, it would just ring again in another 15 minutes or half an hour. Better to take the call now. "Hey, Tengo, were you sleeping?" Komatsu asked, easygoing as usual. "I was trying," Tengo said. "Sorry about that," Komatsu said, sounding not the least bit sorry. "I just wanted to let you know that Air Chrysalis is selling well." "That's great. Like hotcakes. They can't keep up. The poor guys at the printer are working through the night. Anyhow, I figured the numbers would be pretty good, of course. The author is a beautiful 17-year-old girl. People are talking about it. All the elements are in place for a bestseller. Unlike novels written by a 30-year-old cram school teacher who looks like a bear, you mean." "Exactly. But still, you couldn't call this a commercial novel. It's got no sex scenes. It's not a tearjerker. Not even I imagined it would sell so spectacularly." Komatsu paused as if he expected a response from Tengo. When Tengo said nothing, he went on. "It's not just selling a lot, either. The critical reception is wonderful, too. This is no lightweight drama slapped together on a whim by some youngster. The story itself is outstanding. Of course, your superb revision made this possible, Tengo. That was an absolutely perfect piece of work you did." Made this possible. Ignoring Komatsu's praise, Tengo pressed his fingertips against his temples. Whenever Komatsu openly praised Tengo, it was bound to be followed by something unpleasant. Tengo asked Komatsu, "So tell me, what's the bad news?" "How did you know there's bad news? Look what time you're phoning me. There has to be some bad news." "True," Komatsu said, in apparent admiration. "You've got that special sensitivity, Tengo. I should have known." "Sensitivity's got nothing to do with it," Tengo thought. "It's just plain old experience." But he said nothing, and waited to see what Komatsu was getting at. "Unfortunately, you're right. I do have a piece of unpleasant news," Komatsu said. He paused meaningfully. Tengo imagined Komatsu at the other end, his eyes gleaming like a mongoose's in the dark. "It probably has something to do with the author of Air Chrysalis, am I right?" "Exactly. It is about Fukaeri, and it's not good. She's been missing for a while." Tengo's fingers kept pressing against his temples. A while? Since when? 3 days ago, on Wednesday morning, she left her house in Okutama for Tokyo. Professor Ebisuno saw her off. She didn't say where she was going. Later in the day, she phoned to say she